The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Well, hello, everybody. It's good to see you tonight. I'm Homer Hickam, in case you gotten us confused here. Of course, with me is the wonderful Anusha Ansari, and that's what this night is all about, is about Anusha and about this wonderful book that she wrote. Before we get started, again, this night is about Anusha, and I hope everybody's thinking about some good questions to ask her. But I did notice that they did mention my name during the introduction. So I'm kind of curious about the folks here. How many of you have seen the movie October Sky? I'm just curious. Okay. How many of you have read Rocket Boys? Okay. That's not a bad percentage. Folks, we're in a library. Books. Rocket Boys. It's a really good book. Trust me on this. For those of you that are not familiar with my story, which is ultimately going to lead into Anusha's story, and Anusha probably doesn't know this. Anusha, did you know that I'm responsible for the Apollo moon program?
I had no idea.
You didn't know that?
I had no idea, sorry.
Well, here's the story.
It's a fictional story?
It's a true story. Well, I'm from West Virginia. We never let the truth get in the way of a good story. But this is actually a true story. Now, I'm just curious, are there anybody out in the audience that have roots in West Virginia? Okay. There's usually somebody from West Virginia. You're probably a CEO of a company. You're close, right? Wherever I go, West Virginians are in charge of the world. You just don't know it. We kind of stay undercover. So anyway, the story of the Rocket Boys is about me growing up in this little coal town, cold West Virginia, where every adult male was a coal miner and every adult female was the wife of a coal miner, and the coal company owned every house, every fence, every road, every tree. They even owned the churches. The preacher at the church was a company man. He was on a 3-year contract. Every 3 years, we got a different preacher. We like to say we got the low bid religion, you know, whatever it was. Sometimes we were Methodists, and then sometimes we were, which is a good gig. Being a Methodist is pretty easy. But then we become Southern Baptists. And it was kind of hard to, all the women had to take the makeup off. We had to stop dancing on Saturday night. We just couldn't wait for the Methodists to come back. But anyway, So that was the town I grew up in. I guess you know that eventually when the Russians launched Sputnik, and Anusha's story will definitely take us to Russia and what's happening over there today. But when the Russians launched Sputnik, I was the nearsighted second son of Homer and Elsie Hickam. My dad was a foreman there. And my dad was, by the way, I'm Homer Hickam Jr., if you've seen the movie, they called him John in the movie. His real name is Homer. I'm a junior. A quick story on how I got my name. My full name is Homer Hadley Hickam Jr., which is a tough name to carry around your whole life. My older brother, see, in this country, Anusha, usually the older son gets the father's name. My brother's name is Jim. Jim Hickam. With a name like Jim Hickam, you're naturally going to be a football star and get all the girls. But if your name is Homer, you know, there's a problem there. How I got my name was that when I was to be born, my mom was, and all the ladies in Colwood were convinced that I was going to be a girl. And so Mom had picked my name out. I was going to be Susie. And so they had just built a new hospital. Actually, the only hospital. Before then, when you had a baby, you had it upstairs in the bedroom, you know, where everything started. Mm-hmm. So kind of a closed circle to everything. And the company doctor would come and deliver the baby. And so they built this new hospital, and nobody would come. Would you go to a hospital if all you had to do was hang a sign on your front porch that said sick and a doctor showed up? No. But Mom thought little Susie ought to be born in this nice hospital. So she told my dad that little Susie was going to be born in the hospital. And my dad said, Elsie, no, you can't do that because you'd be putting on airs. You know, we don't do that here in Colwood. Come the night that little Susie was to be born, there was a huge blizzard. And between my mom and the hospital were two huge mountains and twisty, curvy roads. And my dad laughed and said, well, Elsie, I guess you're going to have to stay here and have little Susie. And my mom said, well, we'll see about that, buddy. And she hiked up her skirts. She went next door. She got the neighbor lady. They got in the car, and off they head to the hospital, slipping and sliding. And my dad's on the front porch saying, you'll never make it. You'll never make it. But they did make it, and little Susie was born that night with something extra. My mom stayed in the hospital for about 2 weeks. It was great. You know, it was like living in a hotel. She never had it so good. And everybody from Colwood came over. I mean, they didn't want to kick her out. She was about the only patient they had. And everybody from Colwood came over, and except for my dad, he was making a point. And so finally, Dad's boss showed up, Captain Laird, great Stanford University engineer. And she said, Captain, tell Homer if he doesn't come over here and see his new son, I'm headed to Myrtle Beach. That was always her threat. You know, I'm going to take this. And so Captain ordered Dad to come over. And so he came over, and my mom was holding me in her arms. And my dad walked in the hospital room and took one look and said, Elsie, that's the ugliest baby I've ever seen in my life. And turned around and walked out. And the next person in the room was a nurse with a clipboard, and she said, well, Mrs. Hickam, have you decided what you're going to name this baby boy? And she said, why, yes. I'm naming this one after his father. So that's how I got stuck with Homer Hadley Hickam. Anusha is a beautiful name. What does Anusha mean?
It means immortal.
Immortal. Beautiful name. Absolutely beautiful name. Anusha's mom is in the audience, and her name is Faith, although I suspect it's something else in Farsi.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And what is that?
Her name is Fakhri, which means actually, I think, it comes actually from the star.
Perfect. Wow.
Do you want to...
It comes from a star.
Yes.
Yeah. Beautiful name. Absolutely beautiful. Anyway, so how I got the Apollo Moon program. I'm responsible for it.
Yeah, I was going to say, how does being named Homer ties into the...
It may not, actually.
Okay.
I just love to tell that story. It's one of my favorite stories. So anyway, my mom liked it. As a matter of fact, she's the one who told it to me. And Dad would just sit there and say nothing. And it's like, oh, gosh. You know, next thing she knows, she'll be telling the Albert the Alligator story. I'm not telling that tonight, but it's a good one. Anyway, so there I was. And for those of you who've seen the movie and read the book, you know that comes when the Russians launched Sputnik. I was so impressed by that I decided that what I wanted to do more than anything in the whole wide world was to work for Wernher von Braun. And the only way I could figure out how to work for Wernher von Braun was, well, I'd seen my dad interview coal miners, and he would say, well, what can you do? And they'd say, well, I can run a continuous mining machine, or I'm a welder, or, you know, whatever it was. I'm a powder man, whatever it was. And I figured one of these days I would, someday, if I was lucky, I'd sit across the desk from Wernher von Braun, and he would say, Vel, what can you do? And so I figured, well, I better at least be able to tell him that I could build a rocket. So that's how I started in my rocket career. And long story short, eventually I was going to the National Science Fair. And I didn't have a suit, and a classmate of mine convinced my mom that I should go over to the county seat and buy a suit. So the classmate drove me to the county seat, and I went into the men's store. I wouldn't let her come in with me. I could handle this. So I went into the men's store, and when I walked out, I was wearing an orange suit. I'm sure that suit had been hanging in there since the 1920s, and they couldn't sell it. And I thought it was really important to get a suit that kind of stand out at the National Science Fair. And I was so proud of it, I walked out in my orange suit. And I heard a band playing. True story. I heard a band playing, and I thought, well, what's going on? So this is in 1960. was April 1960. So I walked down to where the band was playing there in the county seat. It was the parking garage. And there, standing on the roof of the Lincoln Continental, was Senator John F. Kennedy.
No way.
Yes. He was in West Virginia. You have to have a reason to go there, okay? So he was in West Virginia to win the West Virginia primary. Mm-hmm. And this is a very strange initiative. See, these are some cultural things that you've missed. When they said, John Kennedy was a Catholic, and people were saying, John Kennedy can't be president of the United States because he's a Catholic, and this is, you know, we're all Protestants. And so if he can win in West Virginia, he can win everywhere. And it's like, well, gosh, about half the people I knew were Catholic. This is a stupid thing, but this is what Washington gets into. So anyway, and by the way, Anusha went to a Catholic school, which she'll talk to you about. So not that she's Catholic. She should still be president, but never mind. We'll get into that. Anyway, so I heard this band playing, and I went down, and there was John F. Kennedy, standing on the roof of the Lincoln Continental with a mic in his hand. He had just been down in a coal mine, and he was running against Hubert H. Humphrey, Minnesota. Anybody remember? I liked him because he had three H's in his name, like me. That's the only thing I liked about him. But so Jack Kennedy is standing there, and he's talking to this crowd, which are mostly coal miners. And he is talking about, well, you know, I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to get food stamps, and, you know, I'm going to see about unemployment. And these guys are fully occupied coal miners. They are proud that they're coal miners. They're digging the best coal in the world. So they're just kind of standing there looking at this guy. In the first place, you couldn't understand him because he had this accent, you know, this Massachusetts. Well, you know about that. So, they're just kind of looking at him. And finally, he wasn't getting anywhere with this audience, and he just kind of wound down. And he just in desperation, he said, does anybody have any questions? And I raised my hand, and for some reason, he noticed me right off. And this is true now, Anusha. I have witnesses. I say to Senator John F. Kennedy from Massachusetts running against Hubert H. Humphrey for no apparent reason in southern West Virginia, what do you think we ought to do in space? I'm the rocket boy. That's going to be a natural question for me to ask. And I'll bet you Jack Kennedy had never in the entire history of his life given more than 5 minutes thought to that. This was well before he, you know, became president and all that. So he was there to talk about food stamps and that kind of thing. So he looked at me and he said, well, what do you think we ought to do in space? Which I thought was unfair. I mean, that's unfair to turn the question around on me. So when I was real nearsighted, I have 2400 vision in both eyes, and we had a telescope on top of the clubhouse roof, and all the other boys would look at the stars, and I had trouble seeing them, but I could always see the moon. So I said, well, I think we should go to the moon. And Jack Kennedy looked at me and he said, why would we want to go to the moon? And I looked around at all those coal miners and I said, well, we could just go up there and mine the blame thing. And the coal miners went nuts. They started cheering. They said, the heck, West Virginia miner, we can mine anything. We'll mine that old moon. Let's go. And Jack Kennedy said, well, if I get to be president of the United States, maybe we will go to the moon. So as a matter of fact, we need to get this country moving again. And he started talking about getting the country moving, getting the whole economy going, getting the spirit going, getting the new frontier of the whole thing. And so when I worked for NASA, I started working for NASA when the shuttle flew. And I was doing the Vietnam thing and all that during the Apollo era. A lot of people think that I worked Apollo, but I didn't. I was having to do some other things. So I didn't get to start working for NASA until the 1981 when the shuttle started to fly. And so I would be in my office just as happy as I could be. My little autographed picture of Wernher von Braun hanging on the wall. And waking up every morning and saying, oh, boy, I get to go work for NASA today. It was kind of cool. And the Apollo guys were wandering the halls. shaking their heads and going, oh, gosh, you know. And they'd come into my office and they'd say, Homer, you should have been here during the glory days of Apollo. And I always said, well, you'd have never done anything like that if I hadn't asked Jack Kennedy that question back in 1960. So I took responsibility for the whole thing. Actually, I think Wernher von Braun had a little bit more to do with it. So anyway, I wrote that book, Rocket Boys, and they made that movie. By the way, I apologize to all the young women for not being Jake Gyllenhaal. I do have his cell phone number, and I can be bribed, however, if you want to call. So anyway, so Anusha, the cool thing about, and I'm actually going to let her talk here shortly. Thank you. Yes, you bet, I am. She's much more interesting than I am, but this is part of my price.
I don't know about that.
This is my price. This is my price for coming here. I get to talk a little bit about me. So anyway, so there I was sitting in my office, and I was reading the Huntsville Times. Anusha was just in Huntsville. Anybody from Alabama here, by any chance? A severe shortage of Alabamians in this audience. That's okay. I live in Huntsville, and Anusha graciously came to Huntsville, and we had a great sellout signing of My Dream of Stars. And I forget where I was going with that. Where was I going? Oh, so, no, I was in Huntsville, and so I read in the paper that this woman who was an Iranian-American living in Texas was going to fly to the International Space Station. And I thought to myself, now that is cool. That is special. And I noticed that NASA wasn't making any big deal out of it at all. They were just kind of ignoring it. And I thought, well, that's not right. So I, you know, this modern age, I quickly looked up on the internet and I emailed Anusha. And I didn't get Anusha. I said a note from Homer Hickam, like she's going to know who I am. And so I got an email right back from her assistant who said that Anusha was happy to get my email and that she would really like to talk to me, but she actually had to go get on this Russian rocket in the next few hours and fly into space. And so I kept track of what happened up there, and when you read about not only what happened to Anusha up there, but the whole what led to her going, you're going to be amazed at this at this wonderful story. And so when Anusha came back, somehow we got together, and I convinced her that she had a story that she should tell, and I'm going to let her actually tell it. But as the co-writer, I get to read one little paragraph that Anusha wrote that I think is just splendid and kind of captures the glory of space and why she loves it so much. This is after she gets into space, and somehow I've lost my place, and but I will find it. Let's see. And Anusha can fill in here while I'm looking for this. She can tell you about. Did you actually get that email or know anything about that email at all?
No, I did. I had started blogging a few days before I went to space, and that was my way of sharing my story with the rest of the world. And I was in quarantine in Kazakhstan and Baikonur, where most of the Soyuz launches take place. And I was checking email all the time, and a lot of people had started writing responses to the blogs I was posting, which was surprising to me. I didn't know why would anyone want to read my blog, but, well, there were people who were interested. And, of course, that's when I got Homer's email and, stating that he's very happy that I'm getting to realize a dream I had since I was a child, and he told me that he would look forward to meeting me once I return, and we did. We did get to meet, and actually, I don't think if it wasn't for Homer, I don't think there would be a My Dream of Star, because, as you all know, writing about your past life and your childhood, it's not an easy thing, and it's sometimes not a pleasant thing, because you go through ups and downs in your life, and you rather forget about some of those things. So he had to drag it out of me, help me remember a lot of it, and put it into words and into this book. And at the end, I'm glad I did.
Yeah, Anusha really, really, really is passionate about space and about flying into space, and that's the story that she wanted to tell. And I was very impressed by her blogs that she sent down. For the first time, we had somebody in space that were really giving you the human side of space and what it was really like to be up there. I mean, you know, most of the astronauts are pretty dry in their accounts. But here was something, a real person. And that's why I knew that she had a great, great story to tell. The only problem was that's the only story that Anusha wanted to tell. So, and I can understand that. Well, I can't actually, being in West Virginia. We love to tell everything, you know. But but Anusha is a very private person. So we worked out a system where we got the story told and told beautifully. And Anusha's, I mean, this is a story that ultimately is a very personal story, as you'll see. It's unlike any astronaut story that you'll ever read. You know, Anusha is a very accomplished woman in many, many ways and many facets, and the story of how she left Iran and came over here and how she took advantage of living here is just, to me, is a very fascinating one, and to, actually is the more fascinating to me since I know quite a lot about space and I know a lot of the astronauts and know their story, but none of them have a backstory like Anusha has. Let me read this little paragraph. This is right after Anusha finally gets into space. She's taken off from Kazakhstan, where the Russians have their launch facilities. Her mom was there, and she cried the whole time because I saw the movie. I saw they've made a documentary about it, and Anusha's mom is crying the whole time. She's praying and crying. It's pretty cool. But anyway, so and Anusha wasn't afraid at all. I mean, it's just amazing. She crawled on top of this Russian rocket and flew into space just without any whims at all. So this is once she got into orbit and she's now into weightlessness. She's in this very tiny, cramped little capsule. There are three of them, two great big guys, and Anusha in there. So I can't do this in an Iranian female voice, but I'll do my best. A few moments later, Misha, that's the Russian cosmonaut, said it was okay to open our visors and loosen our belts. L.A., that's the American astronaut, took off a glove and it floated through the cabin. This made me laugh. How often do you read about astronauts laughing? I wondered what these two space professionals thought of me, this giggling schoolgirl they'd carried along. Throwing off my belts, I was able to take a look through the tiny porthole of the capsule and saw Earth from space for the first time. My laughter stopped as tears welled in my eyes, and I saw a small crystal float away from me. It was beautiful, a pretty little diamond, and I wondered where it came from, if perhaps some worker had lost the stone from her ring. Then I realized it was one of my tears. It seemed to be attracted to the earth, and it touched the glass in the porthole and became, for just a moment, the tiniest of rainbows. And I couldn't catch my breath. My beautiful planet, under the warm rays of the sun, turned gracefully beneath me. I was entranced. That's the kind of story that Anusha tells. She just has a passion for it, and maybe she can explain why she has this glorious passion for space.
Well, it all started when I was very, very young, and someone asked me, did someone point at the stars to you and sort of got you started down this path? And I don't remember that. What I remember is summer nights in Tehran can be quite warm, so we would sleep outside. If you had a balcony, you would sleep out in the balcony, and I did. And the best thing I wanted to do summer nights was just lay out there as long as I could and just look at the stars. And while I was doing that as a little girl, I kept thinking about, well, what's out there? I mean, what are these stars? What's are there people living on them? Are they looking back at me? And this whole train of thoughts just kept me going for hours. And that's how my love of the stars started and my curiosity about the stars started. And as I grew up and I went through school, I wanted to learn more about it. I wanted to learn how, you know, how they're made, what's out there, how the whole world came about to be. I mean, I wanted to know about myself, what I was doing there. And I felt that the answer to all these most important life's questions out there amongst the stars, and the only way I can find the answer is for me to fly there and to experience it for myself. And that's how this whole love of stars started for me. And the curiosity about learning about them made me very interested in math and sciences and got me interested in you know, becoming an engineer later on. But it all just started out of a child's curiosity to learn and know what's out there in the universe. And if there are other beings out there and if there are other life forms out there and, you know, what's going on exactly. And of course, you know, growing up in Iran is, you know, wanting to become an astronaut is not something that people took you very seriously. There was no space program in Iran, of course. And I think most people just figured that, you know, as I grow up and become a, you know, young woman, I'll probably forget about this dream of going to space and I will find something better to do. And I did grow up, but that dream never went away and stayed with me even when I came here and ended up completely on a different path. I became an engineer, became a telecommunication engineer, started a career that had nothing to do with going to space. Still, somehow in my heart, I knew that I would find a way one day to fly to space. I had no idea how. I thought maybe I'll win a lottery someday and go to space, or I will make this amazing invention and they will select me to go to space. I didn't know how. I just knew deep down in my heart that it will happen, and I continued looking out for opportunities and ways of learning about what's going on in the space program and sort of keeping an eye on everything. And it eventually paid off. I went about it completely a different way by building a successful career in telecommunication with my husband. And my success in my career is what actually allowed me to fulfill my dream. But it started out with getting involved with the Ansari X Prize, which I talk about in the book. And, you know, knowing that there are millions of people out there like myself who want to go to space and have been dreaming about this since they were very young and disappointed by what they had seen out there, I thought this prize could be the answer, could be the answer to this long, you know, dream of millions of people. And to me, being an entrepreneur myself, I figured entrepreneurs are the ones who can probably find a way to make this into a reality in a very efficient way. And with the Ansari X Prize, we set out to inspire all these people who had this dream to actually put their minds to it, get some money, get some support, and focus on making it into a reality. And it paid off. We had probably about 26 teams from 11 countries competing for the prize. In 2004, one of the American aerospace pioneers and a legend, basically, Bert Rutan, won the prize. He built a spaceship called Spaceship One that flew into space in 2004 twice within 2 weeks, which was the one of the criteria to win the prize, and successfully demonstrated that a small group of entrepreneurs with a passion can get together and with a fraction of what a space agency could spend, build a spaceship. And that was a huge success. And we had proven our point. Prior to that date, every time I talked to anyone about going to space, you know, they just sort of laughed and they thought that it's just crazy talk. And after 2004, every time I talked about going to space, it was completely a different story. and people didn't think it was that funny anymore. I remember, you know, my husband always, he's not a big space fan, but he just gets a kick out of it. So we would be at dinner and they would ask us, so what are you doing? And he would say, well, we're building spaceships. And people would look at us just like, you know, is he for real? I mean, what is he drinking? So it definitely changed it after 2004. And that's how my sort of my path changed and sort of became a more direct path in an area that I really wanted to make some accomplishment. And eventually ended up in, you know, in Russia. I got an offer to go and train as a backup to learn about the Russian space program as we were trying to put a prize, orbital prize together. And, you know, maybe if someone else was in my place and someone offered them, do you want to go live in Star City, Russia, in a military camp for 6 months and train as a backup? They would have said, are you kidding me? This is a crazy idea. Why would I do that? Well, I said the same thing. I said, wow, it's a crazy idea. I would love to do that. And ended up there. I just, the idea that I will be walking in the same hallways that Yuri Gagarin walked in and, you know, just being there with actual people who've been to space, with the astronauts and cosmonauts, that whole idea was just enough for me to spend 6 months there and to train, even though I didn't even know if I would ever go to space. And ended up there, and, you know, one thing led to another, and 3 weeks before the flight, of course, the person who was supposed to fly had nothing to do with it, but he failed one of his medical exams, and because I had decided that I wanted to take this chance, and I was there, I got the opportunity to take that seat and to make my dream come true, and it was an amazing, exciting, unbelievable moment for me when they told me, do you want to take that seat? And I think it didn't take about a split second for me to say, are you kidding me? Of course I would. Because I was actually screaming at the top of my lung when I said that. But it was definitely, you know, one of those rare moments that if you are not ready for it, could pass you by, and you may never know it happened and always regret it. But I was there, and I took advantage of it, and I got on that rocket, and I went to space.
Wow.
you see what part of the story she's passionate about? But, of course, I love the story about her coming from Iran and how she came to the United States, and that was fascinating to me. And as I've said, you know, this story is much closer to 1,000 Splendid Suns than The Right Stuff. So I think you're really going to like this book. I think we can now open it up to Q&A. So that's always fun to at least, you know, when I'm by myself, I know there's at least one person out there interested in what I'm having to say since they asked me a question. But like I said, this is Anusha's book, and so do we have any questions out here? Yes, right there, go in.
This is a question for both of you, and you can answer it in any order you want. Mm-hmm. I understand you're going to be on television tomorrow at 6 a.m. on Fox and Friends explaining why we should be back in space again. So I'd be interested, because I don't wake up at 6 o'clock, in a very...
Do you have TiVo? Can you TiVo?
No. In a very abbreviated version, and I'd like both of you to answer this, why should we be back in space again?
Well, since I'm the one on Fox and Friends, I'm not sure that question will come up. I'm primarily going on to promote Anusha as the new NASA administrator. I want her to take over NASA. I think she'd do a better job than anybody else. I'm going to let Anusha answer, of course, about why we should be in space, but just talking in terms of NASA itself. NASA, to me, is a program that fulfills what I consider the three requirements of any federal program. It's what I call LSE. The L is for life, the quality of life. NASA, through its lifetime, has produced a great quality of life for Americans. And, you know, when you use your cell phone, you see a flat screen TV, any of that technology is a result. You can thank NASA for that. It all ultimately came out of that because they needed to miniaturize. They had little rockets compared to what Russia had at first. They had to miniaturize everything, so they learned how to do all that. So the quality of life of the NASA enhances the quality of life of people in this country. The S is spirit. NASA is the program that creates a wonderful spirit in this country, and you just have to, almost any school kid that you talk to, I mean, they're thrilled by the idea of NASA, and they want to be an astronaut. Whether they become an astronaut or not doesn't really matter. The fact that they want to do it, and they want to study, and they want to, that's their example. So the spirit. And the third one is the economy, the, you know, life, spirit, and the economy. For every dollar spent on NASA, $7 goes into our economy. If we lost NASA, we would lose that great driver of our American economy, so we don't dare lose it. And so I'm kind of passionate about that, and on Fox and Friends I'm going to talk about that, some of the wrong decisions I think is being made right now. That's my opinion, not Anisha's. So that's kind of my response. So, Anisha.
Well, I've always been a proponent of space exploration because I feel it plays a huge role in our sustainability as a species in this universe. I think, you know, sometimes we take it for granted. We feel like because nothing's going to happen in our lifetime, like when, you know, we're young, we think we'll never get old and we'll never get sick. Same thing happens. We think that we'll live forever and nothing's going to happen in our lifetime, and we really don't care what's going to happen, you know, hundreds of, you know, years from now. But space is something that unless you spend time and effort on it, it's not something that you can, you know, send people to space at a whim. It takes a lot of you know, work and preparation and just getting ourselves as a species ready to live in space, it will take many, many years. And it's something that we have to do because it will become an important thing for, you know, many generations to come. And this is just one part of it. Today, one of the biggest problems here on our planet is resources. We're resource constrained, and that's cause of war and cause of a lot of conflicts. And guess what? A lot of these resources are available in space in abundance. And if we find safe, peaceful way of taking advantage of these resources, it could help us here. And it could create lots of jobs. It could create a lot of reason for innovation. And all of these are reasons that I feel very passionate about why we need to make sure that we have a very vibrant and innovative space exploration program, whether it's with government agencies or private industries. The best is to have them both work together and create something that's good for humanity.
Just to put it all in context, NASA gets 0.5% of the federal budget. That's around $19 billion in a $3.5 trillion budget. It's essentially a rounding error. If you got rid of it, it wouldn't matter. The Department of State gets 3 times more money than NASA does. What's the Department of State done for you lately? Last time I went to one of the embassies, I had a passport problem. They just basically blew me off. You know, that's like, you know. So I don't know what they do if they're $60 billion at all. Department of Commerce gets more money than NASA does. It's a little agency that can. And again, it feeds our economy like no other agency does. So just keep that in mind. In the back there? Yes, sir.
Hi, thank you, Anisha and Homer. Wonderful storyteller you are. Just a not quite hypothetical question. When will there be cruise through the solar system? It might take about 60 years to complete. I'd love the finances that could come from that.
Did you get the question?
So when will there be a cruise? You're talking about a manned cruise or just an exploration?
The ocean is safe. Let's get on board.
I'm there with you.
Yeah, I think we're true believers. I'll just say quickly that we will not go to Mars using chemical rockets. It's too far, in my opinion. We're talking about 10 months or more out there to Mars with all the radiation and everything. It takes too long on a chemical rocket. We will use big boomers. We'll use nuclear rockets when we go so that we can actually accelerate out and decelerate down. It's all a matter of will, and it doesn't cost that much. We just have to get the leadership that wants us to go do it. And we've got the technology is there. We just have to get, you know, our leaders to say, let's go, like Jack Kennedy did, said, let's go to the moon and do the other things, and we did.
Go ahead.
Is this perhaps like I'm sorry, part two?
Well, cruising through the solar system, I think it's a little bit a bigger challenge, but I think that we have to take many steps that will lead to that. Unfortunately, I don't think it happened in my lifetime, but maybe I'll come back and be able to experience it again. But it's important. I mean, that's why I was excited, actually, about going back to the moon, because one way that we can get experience is to have a permanent base where we can constantly send people and spend extended amount of time in space, so we learn how to adjust. Unless we find out how to adjust as human beings, how our bodies can be adjusted to spending an extended period of time in space, it will be difficult to take some of those longer trips like a cruise or in the solar system. But definitely it's something that's needed, and we should work toward it one step at a time and find ways to achieve it. And I can promise you that the XPRIZE Foundation will be coming up with a lot of prizes to take those steps.
Yeah, I'm one of those guys that looks at the moment and says, okay, what's everybody interested in right now? I can put the hook out there for the moon. I mean, I even say that the moon program is an anti-terrorism policy. And I actually believe that. If you're a young kid and you walk out your mud hut and you look up and you look at the moon and you know that people are up there working, you want to be part of that. That's a very positive thing. So it's very visible to the whole world. And you say, wow, there's some people up there doing some really cool things. And so I'm going to study hard, and I'm going to, you know, I'm not going to go blow myself up. I got better things to do than that. So. Yes.
So, Anisha, did you come back in the Soviet space capsule? And if you did, what are the landings like?
The question was if I landed on this Soyuz, on the Russian program also. I did. I returned on the older capsule that was on the ice, because the Soyuz capsule is actually used as an escape vehicle and for the space station, and they cycle it every 6 months. So you go up on one Soyuz, it stays there, and you come back on the one that's been there for 6 months. The capsule is a lot like an Apollo capsule, but smaller, and it lands, you know, sort of similarly with a parachute, but it lands on the ground, so it's not landing on water. So it's a very impactful landing, and it's almost like being in a car crash. So if I were to say which was the most unpleasant part of the entire experience, I even like the landing, but that would be it. That whole impact on the ground probably it's something that I could have done with that. We went up to normally on a normal land. When it hits, I don't think you're going through G forces, but coming into the atmosphere, you're going through 4.5 Gs. If they do off nominal landing, then you could go up to 9 Gs, but fortunately I only experienced 4.5, and I was pretty happy about that.
Yeah. It's kind of instantaneous. It has retro rockets, and right before it touches the ground, it goes off. And I think Anisha felt, as you're reading the book, she felt like that they'd actually just buried into the earth, that's how hard they hit. But that was the retro rockets going off. I think they went off a little late on your capsule. I watched the documentary the other day. It looks a little late on me.
I thought it was like, you know, by the time they fired, we were on the ground.
Yeah,
how did that go?
I don't know. In the back, yes, sir.
Anisha, have you had a chance to meet any of the other Middle Eastern astronauts or cosmonauts, the Saudi Arabian, Syrian, or Afghanistan?
No, I have not, actually. I will have an opportunity in the next couple of months to meet the Saudi astronaut, but I haven't met any of the other ones. I've seen their pictures, but I haven't met them in person.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi there. I understand that your book is also a love story. Can you explain that, please?
Well, it's a love story because I think it started out with my love for the stars. And when you read throughout the story, you will see that my husband has played a huge role in my life. And the love of my family and their support also has played a big role in, you know, what I have achieved in my lifetime. And at the end of the day, I feel like maybe the answer I got from this entire experience is the most important thing in your life is to live a life of passion, live a life full of love and love of the people around you. And that's what makes life worth living. And I think it comes through throughout the book and through my experience.
Yeah, she has a beautiful love story, how she met Hamid, her husband, actually through her brother-in-law, who went through all kinds of gyrations to get those two together. He's basically a very studious kind of guy, and he had to become a party animal. He started throwing parties with any excuse to get Hamid and Anusha together, and it worked. And they are a great team, and you know, it's just wonderful to see them together, and Amir is part of their company too. And also your sister, Atusa?
My sister. There are four engineers in the family, and the four of us have been working together since the beginning.
In the red, yes, sir.
Well, this is for Anusha. Did you receive most of your technical education in Iran?
I came here when I was in 11th grade and finished high school in Virginia and went to George Mason University for my bachelor degree in electrical engineering, and then continued to George Washington for my master's degree.
Yeah, it was one of the reasons that that she came over here. It was after the revolution, and I don't know. You can speak better than I can, but it's much more difficult for a woman to get a technical education, I think, in Iran than over here.
So. I would say so. First of all, you know, there's an entrance exam that because there are limited number of seats, and sometimes you don't get to choose what you want to study. But then at the same time, it's not just the, you know, qualifying academically, which I felt that I could qualify academically and pass the exam. But then at that time, they had this whole sort of background check that you had to pass. And my family didn't necessarily qualify under the new regime as, you know, under the rules that they had. So I figured, you know, my chances of getting an education, especially in the field that I wanted to, would be very slim.
So Anusha's mom said, okay, Anusha and Atusa, you're going to the States. It wasn't quite that easy. It took some doing for them to come over here. But and you didn't speak a word of English when you got here?
No, I spoke French. I went to a French Catholic school, and I have a schoolmate who's here. We went to a school called Jeanne d'Arc, we studied French half of the day, and then Farsi the rest of the day, and you know, never knew that I had to learn English because I would end up in the United States. So, but because I knew at least French, it helped me to come up to speed very quickly and learn English very quickly.
Let's look at somebody right up front here. Yeah.
Hi, I was wondering what you think of Virgin Galactic. And maybe you're thinking of a second trip into space?
Absolutely. I'm very excited about Virgin Galactic. Of course, you know, Richard Branson signed up to take the design that Bert Rutan came up with use Spaceship One to build Spaceship Two. And, you know, of course, the biggest difference is that it's a lot bigger. It's going to carry 7 passengers. they're doing great. I keep very close in touch with BERT and what's happening at Virgin Galactic. I think 2011 is when they estimate they will be able to fly commercial passengers, and I hope to be one of the passengers that will fly on Virgin Galactic. Look forward to it.
Yeah, Anusha's buying me a seat. you did say that, didn't you?
Can, of course, buy me. But one thing is, I tell people, you know, once you experience space, is like becoming a space junkie, and you really want to have, even if it's small experiences, to have these experiences. So if I get a chance, you know, to go fly a zero-G flight, I will definitely sign up for it, or even if it's a suborbital flight, it doesn't matter. Just being one step closer to that experience, whatever that is, it's definitely something that people would want to do.
Yeah, you didn't even want to sleep when you were in space, did you?
I didn't, and I kept myself up as much as I could. And because of that, when we were landing, you know, as they were preparing everything, I kept falling asleep. You know, you have to go through the checklist, and they're like, you know, my crewmates are like, Anusha, are you okay? I'm like, yes, I'm okay. I just can't keep my eyes open. And they were like, this lady is crazy, because that's like the most dangerous part of the whole trip. You know, everyone's nervous about the landing. And I'm like, I'm just falling asleep there. So because I didn't want to sleep while I was on station.
Yeah, she actually got to smell space, too. What does space smell like, and how did that come about?
Well, I get laughed at a lot because of that, too. But, you know, when we dock to the space station, of course you can't go out and smell space, but when we dock to the space station, before they open the hatch, my crewmates told me, L.A. and Misha said, well, Anusha, here's your chance to smell space, because we're going to open the hatch on this side, on the Soyuz side first, and you can smell the air that's trapped between the two hatches. So they opened the hatch and said, so what does it smell like? And I said, it smells like a burnt cookie. And they're like, we've never heard that one before, a burnt cookie. But it did. To me, it did smell like a burnt almond cookie, nevertheless.
So
very specific.
So now we know why Captain Kirk is out there. He's looking for that burnt cookie. And you got to meet Captain Kirk, too, didn't you? Yeah. James Tiberius Kirk, otherwise known as William Shatner,
yes.
On the bus to watch Spaceship One fly.
I have to tell you, that was one of the most exciting things that happened that day to me, too. I mean, I grew up watching. It's like, Captain Kirk is here.
I know that. No doubt thrilled William Shatner, too. And he was wearing a hat with your name on it, too. Which is,
yes,
cool.
We had made these Ansari X Prize hats. So I have a picture with William Shatner wearing an Ansari, you know, X Prize hat. So I told my brother-in-law, who's also a big Trekkie, I said, did you ever think that we will be standing next to Captain Kirk with our family name on a hat?
I said, no. Pretty cool.
It's one of them.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I have a lucky job. I get to teach sixth graders astronomy, 11-year-olds, and they're really weirdly excited about astronomy. What would be your message to the youth of today? You, both of you, what would you say to them? And you probably do get a chance to talk to young folks. What do you tell them?
I actually do spend a lot of time talking to young kids, and I specifically like to talk to students in middle school, because I feel like that's where you sort of can influence them a little bit. And I even started a prize that I do every year for middle schools. But most important thing I want them to do is to use their imagination. They have a vivid imagination. I want them to use that imagination and pick their curiosity in something. And I think that's the way they get interested. Sometimes the way we try to teach science is difficult to, you know, get kids' interest. And, you know, allowing them to experience things on their own terms and get curious about something and want to learn more and more about it. Just the way I got curious about the stars and I wanted to learn more about them. So I really encourage them, and while I'm talking to the kids, sometimes I hope the teachers are also listening. And I love it that you're teaching astronomy. I think astronomy is one of those most fascinating subjects that if it's taught to kids at a young age, it will really open their minds up to so many different things. And I admire you for doing that.
Yeah, I'll echo that. Thank you for being a teacher. It's not an easy job these days. Miss Raleigh, who was our wonderful teacher of the Rocket Boys, is now an icon across the world, and people want to know the Miss Raleigh story. Of course, one of the things I say when how to get my kids interested in space and other things, I always say, well, you need to get them to read Rocket Boys, of course. That's very helpful. But what I talk about is the three P's of success. The Rocket Boys figured out on their own how to succeed because they had these three P's. One of them was passion. They had a passion for building rockets, and they weren't going to let anything stand in their way. And so I tell kids, you don't have to want to be in a space program. You don't want to be an astronaut, or you don't want to. That's fine. But you do need to figure out what your passion in life is. And so go away, get and talk to yourself. Turn off the radio, turn off the TV, turn off your kids, I mean your friends, turn off everybody for a moment and think about what you really, 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 really want to do in life. What is it that every morning you're going to wake up and you say, oh boy, I get to go do that. I've been very lucky in that regard. It may be you just want to be a NASCAR auto mechanic. I don't care what it is. You just have to have that passion. So you have to first figure out what that is. In this country, if you've got a passion for something and you stand up and tell somebody, there's somebody going to help you do it. And that's the second P, and that's the plan. Somebody's going to help you get a plan. You got to put a plan together. How am I going to become a NASCAR auto mechanic? Well, you need to first meet one, and you need to go, you know, maybe apprentice to one or whatever. You figure, you get somebody to help you to figure out the plan. And then the third P is perseverance. Perseverance, perseverance, perseverance. If you've got a passion and you've got the plan and you've got the perseverance, it will happen. And I firmly believe in that. It just will. And Anusha is a perfect example of that. She had the passion. It took her a while to get the plan, but once she got it, she persevered. And as you will see, she really had to persevere within the Russian program to get to go fly. So three P's of success.
There's one.
Government, this is sort of piggybacking on the nature of the private spaceflight sector. Government has typically been responsible for spaceflight technologies because of the massive upfront investment and the inability to realize profit on any sort of term that anybody wants to consider, even a lifetime. But with the Ansari X Prize and additionally with the success of Virgin Galactic and SpaceX, it seems more plausible that the private sector is going to contribute more and more. And as such, the White House has allocated substantial funding sort of away from NASA and towards these private sector corporations. And I'm wondering if that is going to essentially prioritize very short-term goals such as that have a profit attached to them, such as space tourism, at the expense of maybe intrinsically more necessary and more intriguing technologies that maybe NASA would fund with no expectation of some sort of profit that they're going to realize. And I'd like to know, I guess both of you, what you would think, because since you have, Mr. Hickam, you have experience in NASA, Ms. Ansari, you're in the private sector.
I think there is a perfect marriage to be made there. I think that there are certain areas like what you talked about where it involves technology that has already been proven by NASA and the ability for the entrepreneurs to take that experience, take that technology, and turn it into something that's more efficient, more reusable, and something that can be repeated into a profitable business model. And a lot of the activities on the low Earth orbit would fall into that category. And then you have things like going to Mars. I mean, funding a private mission going to Mars would be much more difficult, and I don't think it will be feasible without collaboration, cooperation, and a lot of work from NASA. So I think there is a really good marriage to be made with collaborative effort between the two sectors, and there's a lot to be gained by NASA because they can focus their time and energy and the fundings towards some of those riskier, longer-term missions. I hope that they will become a little bit more open to taking risk, because I think one of the problems there is also, you know, the policies that prevent them from taking risk. And then pass on some of the other responsibilities to the private sector and let them run with it and grow and create new jobs and new industries.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I'm a big supporter of SpaceX, a little company that could. They've got Falcon 9 sitting on the launch pad down at the Cape right now. They may be able to build a capsule. They know that they're going to build one that carries cargo. Whether they have the knowledge to build one that carries crew, I'm not sure about. One thing to keep in mind, though, NASA doesn't build rockets or spacecraft. Actually, contractors already do that. Their commercial companies already do that. So essentially, the new plan is to allow NASA is still going to be the primary customer. They just have a little bit more independence to go off and build these things. Ultimately, Nusha is absolutely right. The problem with the new plan was they came down with they're going to throw money at the commercial companies like SpaceX and also the Russians to fly our astronauts into space, but they had nothing in mind for NASA to do. So we're looking at 10,000 engineers. We're looking at these huge, wonderful facilities that we have. We're looking at closing down, Launch Control Center at the Cape, closing down Mission Control Center in Houston, closing down all of the propulsion test beds that we have in Marshall Space Flight Center with no plan and what to do with these folks. So that's my primary complaint about the new policy, is that one side, the commercialization was good, but they canceled our moon program and have nothing in mind for our people to do. So Congress is going to end up designing our space program, same people bringing you health care. So.
Unless I become the new NASA administrator, and yes. I have a lot of good plans.
Yes, and that's, I'm Fox and Friends, I'm talking Anusha up tomorrow. So we're going to start this bandwagon, because Anusha, she's got, no, it's more than a rumor. I've got 3 senators in my pocket, and you've got 1, so it's 4.
I have none, so I can't.
Yes, you do. Well, I'm from West Virginia. We automatically assume that our 2 senators are in our pockets. Okay, we're out of time. We're going to sign. I actually have to bail rather early because I have a train to catch to be on Fox and Friends. So I have pre-signed. So if you want to, I hope that you'll be interested in Rocket Boys. There are a number of copies in October Sky, which is the same book, by the way. But I really hope that you'll get this book, My Dream of Stars. It's a wonderful book. I think you're going to love it, and I hope that you'll convince all of your family and friends that they also need to, don't loan it out. They should buy their own copy. You can give it as a gift. It'd be all good. So so we're going to sign out here.
Okay. Upstairs.
This way?
Upstairs.
Upstairs. So we're now going to be led to where we're going to sign. So thank you very much, folks. I really appreciate you coming.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.